This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This election cycle is breaking plenty of records, and not just with our level of exasperation. The money flowing into and out of political campaigns is flooding our screens and mailboxes with attack ads and vaguely hopeful messaging. The Senate race between Cal Cunningham and Tom Tillis broke the record for most expensive non-presidential race. So where's the money coming from? Today, we're going to take a look at ways donations and spending are reshaping the state's political landscape. I'm joined by Jason DeBruin, WUNC's data reporter and a fellow with Guns and America. Hello, Jason.
Hey, Frank.
Good to have you here. Grace Haley is also here. She is the gender and race researcher for the Center for Responsive Politics, runs a website that makes campaign finance records more easily available, opensecrets.org. Grace, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. We're going to talk about campaign finance today, so a lot of numbers, and I know that's what both of you do for a living, but let's talk about these things in terms of the magnitude of spending and use comparisons. Maybe we can stay away from the millions and billions and try to look at comparisons and trends. So, Jason, let's start with that U.S. Senate race. We know this is the most expensive non-presidential race ever, but how much more expensive is it than, well, let's say the governor's race, for example?
Oh, well, if you compare to the governor's race, it's many multiples more. The one that actually, the comparison that I prefer to look at is, you mentioned that 6 years ago, we did also set a record in that Tillis-Hagen race that Senator Tillis won. That was about $125 million total spent. Well, already this year, we're double that. I mean, we're already at double, and there's still 2 weeks to go, and a good amount of reporting that has yet to come in. So we're already double what set a record just 6 years ago. And I was talking earlier today with our colleague Jeff Tiberi. He was saying that some of his sources were estimating that it could reach as much as $750 million just in this one Senate race. Now, I apologize for using dollar terms. I know you said you didn't want that, but the number is just so amazing to me that for one Senate seat, it could reach that amount of money. So it's an incredible amount of spending. And then when you compare it to the governor's race, it's many multiples more than that. I mean, if you look, you know, compared to what Governor Cooper is spending this year, or what he spent last, or excuse me, 4 years ago, I mean, it's like three and four times that much.
And let's get a broader time span here to get a sense of how things have changed over time. Grace, both parties fought hard for that seat between Kay Hagan and Tom Tillis 6 years ago. Let's go back earlier. Let's go back to 1984. Tight battle between Jesse Helms and Jim Hunt. That cost over 12 times as much as the 1980 race. So, again, I'm getting confusing here, but in 84, there's a race that was 12 times 1980. And now, how do we compare to that race in 1984 these days?
I mean, we just have to think about the differences in how people are fundraising to begin with. So two of the biggest factors that are at play here within North Carolina's U.S. Senate race is, one, an exorbitant amount of outside spending be spent by super PACs. So after the pivotal Supreme Court case, Citizens United, we have so much more money in general legally being allowed to spend, being spent in these elections. And two, we have a huge rise in money coming from small donors using platforms like ActBlue and WinRed, which are the online fundraising platforms being used by campaigns, which is making it easier than ever to donate to campaigns and to be donating consistently small amounts of money at the touch of a fingertip.
Yeah, but that's interesting in and of itself. The idea was, I mean, for forever, obviously, the political parties were going after deep pockets, people with a lot of money to get those big hit donations. But you're saying what's really putting, or what's helping to put us over the top, are those little $5, $10, $25 donations, right?
Yeah. So I guess we're really seeing this big gap. We're seeing billionaires spending millions of money going towards super PACs, and we're seeing millions of dollars being raised by millions of people outside of North Carolina through small donor platforms going to this campaign. So we're kind of seeing both simultaneously in these really extreme forms.
That's interesting. I mean, on the one hand, it does suggest at least that democracy still functions, right? Because all this money is being spent to persuade voters. So in other words, there is still some function of, you know, so the democratic process is functioning. Voting matters. matters so much. We're spending tens of billions of dollars to persuade you. But let's talk about, and so, but part of the democratic process then too is us understanding that, right? I mean, what we hear over and over again in the argument over campaign spending is, well, transparency is everything. As long as we know who is spending what and how much is being spent, doesn't matter. And that way everybody gets to play the game. But Jason, Citizens United unlocked unlimited political campaign spending, and government transparency advocates have been playing catch up ever since. And one of the big frustrations is really how to get at who is paying for what, right?
Well, and that's the problem. As you know, political spending was equated with free speech. And I think in a vacuum, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But of course, the point of free speech is that you're allowed to say whatever you want. Of course, when you're out on the street saying something, people clearly know that it's you that's saying that. Well, with dark money, we don't necessarily always know who is making the donations. And the key to this is that anybody can create a limited liability corporation, an LLC, and they can name it essentially whatever they want, and they can have a registered agent that's not even necessarily affiliated with them. So then they can transfer money from their personal accounts into this LLC that's named, you know, something innocuous like, you know, Go USA LLC, and then it's that company that then makes donations to super PACs or, you know, perhaps to candidates directly, and it becomes very difficult to trace that money back to the initial donor. And I think that's the problem that open government or good government folks see in the system as it's currently operating, is that if you want to support a candidate, if you want to support a cause, if you're a billionaire and you want to spend millions of your own money to try to influence an election, that's well and good. But the point is, you have to put your own name with that donation so that people know that it's you that's donating to that candidate. And that's important because then, of course, if a candidate wins on down the road, then all of a sudden they vote one way or another on a certain issue. Well, if they know that somebody from the oil and gas industry, for instance, was making a big donation and something related to oil and gas comes up on the Senate floor, that there's then a potential critique or an investigation into why this candidate is voting one particular way or the other. And it just becomes increasingly difficult to know who the players are and who the influencers are if we're not able to track or we're not able to know where those donations originated from.
We're talking about campaign spending today on The State of Things. Jason DeBruin, WUNC data reporter, is with me, as well as Grace Haley, gender and race researcher for the Center for Responsive Politics. And Grace, you've made it your living to follow this money. Tell us what we do know about dark money. How much can we say, and how do you get the information that we need to help us understand, you know, where this money's coming from?
Yeah, so that's a little bit outside of my research focus, since I spend most of my time looking into the demographics of who is spending and raising this money going towards candidates. So if I can pivot us to the small donors aspect again, which I find so fascinating because the research and academic studies show that with this rise of small donors contributing towards campaigns, we are seeing a more representative look at who is donating to campaigns, where with small amounts of money getting donated to campaigns, like $10 contributions going towards a Senate or presidential race, more often we're seeing the huge array, diverse array of demographic groups in America be able to kind of have their preferred candidates know that they have this support, be able to become competitive candidates in the first place. And oftentimes I think we see a difference in the candidates who have this great amount of small dollar and small donor support versus some of these candidates who have a lot of big dark money amounts being spent towards or against their campaign.
Well, and it's interesting to see which kind of races, too, that this money plays a part in. UNC Charlotte political science professor Eric Heberlig talked about this point one of the most recent episodes of the WUNC Politics podcast.
In most of the high-profile races and most of the competitive races, voters are hearing lots from both sides. So, yeah, we're seeing lots of outside spending, but we're seeing lots of outside spending on behalf of both candidates or attacking both candidates. So in some ways, that's lots of money that's canceling out the money on the other side. And in the end, it may make a difference, but voters are kind of fully informed by having all that money spent. Where I'm more concerned about the influence of the outside money is in lower profile races where voters don't have alternative sources of information, especially if all that money is really coming in only on one side. So judges races, for example, voters know very little about judges. If there's a group that comes in there, spends a lot, particularly in the last week when the other side doesn't have the ability to counteract, that frankly is going to dominate the information that voters have and is probably going to swing the election to the candidate that benefits from that outside spending.
That's UNC Charlotte Professor Eric Heberleg on the WNC Politics Podcast. We'll talk about that influence and whether or not small donations are acting as a counterweight against the dark money, which is coming from larger donors and maybe influencing smaller races. All of that today on The State of Things with Grace Haley from the Center for Responsive Politics and WNC's Jason DeBruin, all with me to talk about money and politics. But I also want to remind you that Movies on the Radio is coming up, and we want to hear your pick for the best or worst sequel. Tweet at us with your choice at the hashtag SOTMovie or email sot@wnc.org. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Talking today to Grace Haley, gender and race researcher for the Center for Responsive Politics. It runs the website Making Campaign Finance Records More Easily Accessible, opensecrets.org. And Jason DeBruin, WNC's data reporter and a fellow with Guns and America. Grace, just before the break, we heard that clip talking about the outsized influence of outside money on down ballot races. But we're in this interesting moment, it seems to me, based on your research, looking at the growing influence of smaller donations. And I'm wondering if we're in this breach at the moment where those smaller donations are maybe opening up and acting as a counterweight against what had been kind of institutional money. It was easy for the Democratic Party as an institution to raise money from deep pockets. Is this opening things up for and sort of acting as a counterweight against dark money?
I think this is a really interesting question that I think that we're still seeing the answer developing in real time. To kind of put this in perspective, it's well documented that the demographic makeup of our political leaders is not representative of our current population, as is the demographic makeup of a lot of these big top donors who are donating to super PACs, who we are able to track. Dark money, we aren't able to do that because we don't know the identities of who's donating this money. But as majority of Congress is made up of white and male leaders, the majority of candidates are also largely white and male. The major work that is being done to challenge the status quo, we're seeing it happening while we're ushering in candidates from a plethora of identity groups who are not often seen in Congress. So we're seeing a lot of House races, especially, where candidates from backgrounds who we often don't see in Congress are able to not rely on these big, large donor donations and are able to reach a broader constituency, which we can see through this rise in small donors donating to their campaigns.
Well, Jason, that raises the question, if we're in this moment now of transition, let's take a look back a little bit and see what the older system, right, the one that was based on those bigger donations, has brought to us. I want to turn back the clock to the primaries. In this election cycle, the stark differences between the two Democrats running for the U.S. Senate seat here in North Carolina and their ties to the party establishment. Erica Smith had served three terms in the state Senate, a party-line Democrat, but she didn't have the same connections as her opponent, Cal Cunningham. So what are some of the party mechanisms and sort of how that race played out to deliver the victory, the primary victory, to Cal Cunningham, Jason?
Well, the political parties do play a big role, particularly when it comes to the primaries. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean, we are in a time now where you sort of want to affiliate with one party over the other. And look, people are busy. People have things to do. And so if there's a group of people that are aligned with them, generally speaking, and are in the business of sort of figuring out all the minutiae of policy, it kind of makes sense for, you know, regular people, even like myself, to say, okay, I identify a little bit more of the values with this one party over this other one. Of course, when it comes to primaries, there's just less information available than in the general election about every candidate. And so the parties do then have outsized influence. And that's not just in money per se, but it's also just in the infrastructure that exists, right? I mean, you know, they have email lists of people. They have people in the smaller, you know, in the party chapters at, you know, that are all throughout the state. And so if the party decides we think this particular candidate has a better chance than this over this other candidate to ultimately win in November, then they're going to be, you know, sort of putting their effort behind that first candidate. Anticipating your question, you're going to say that that sort of diminishes the democratic process. I mean, I agree with that in sort of just literal terms, but I mean, if you're a political party, your goal is to win, right? And your goal is to win as many seats as possible, and certainly to defeat whoever, you know, is running from the other party. And if you sincerely believe that one candidate has a better chance of winning in November than another candidate in the same party, then it sort of makes sense for you to push that candidate. Now, I'm not saying that I'm not making the argument that I think Cunningham was the best candidate. I'm just saying from a purely, you know, logical sense, parties, it's in their best interest to find a candidate that they think has the best chance of winning and then backing that candidate.
But my question happened this actually year in that race. My question is actually going to be, where does that logic come from and what's the foundation of that logic? That's really the question. And I think to get at that, I want to play this clip from a news feature from WNC's Jeff Tabiri and political consultant Thomas Mills.
He is an establishment-backed military veteran with a vault full of resources. She's the grassroots contender, a sitting state senator trying to advance on a shoestring budget. He is white. She is black.
I mean, Erica Smith has a great profile, but I don't think she really, she didn't play her cards very well.
Thomas Mills is a Democratic consultant. He is not working for any of the candidates in this race. His critique stems from more than a year ago when Smith entered this race.
If you're going to jump in a race that early, the whole reason to do it is to show that you've got the money and the connections and the organization to clear the field.
Donations to Smith's campaign did not follow in the first quarter of 2019, nor the second. Neither did a formidable campaign infrastructure. Cunningham had been running for lieutenant governor, but jumped races when he saw an opportunity. He has since raised millions and been assisted by millions more in outside support.
Democratic political consultant and former congressional candidate Thomas Mills speaking to WNC's Jeff Tabiri. And of course, you can hear more of Jeff's analysis through the WNC podcast, politics podcast. But Grace, let's go into what Thomas Mills said. Look, she didn't do what she should have done. She didn't raise the money. She's a black woman who ran twice successfully for the state Senate and somehow was still not able to raise the money against someone who had not had that much political success in the state. And I know that Beyond Policy, your research looks at the ways race and gender dynamics play a part in this. To what extent is this a self-fulfilling prophecy? Yes, she didn't win money, therefore she can't win, therefore we're behind Cal Cunningham. I mean, talk about the way money sort of plays a reverse role here.
Yeah, so there's just so much to be said on this, especially about the electability question and who is even viewed as a competitive or a electable candidate in the first place. And time and time again, we see that the biggest hurdles for women, especially women of color, but other various demographic groups, is fundraising. And fundraising is often the number one thing people point to as the biggest barrier running for office. And it's kind of an exponential cyclical issue because fundraising signals to wealthy large donors that you're a competitive candidate and that you're connected to the political elite class. Fundraising gives you the social media and TV ad buys to give you the opportunity to have viral moments that often usher in small donor support. Fundraising allows you to hire a team to help with your campaign. And there are even legal battles to allow fundraising funds to go towards childcare costs for parents, especially mothers, to be able to have full-time resources to dedicate to an election. So fundraising is tied to the material reality of campaigns and is tied to the systematic racist and sexist barriers that often exist for people running for office. And so we see with Black women, Latina women, Native American women, Asian Pacific Islander women, and sometimes white women, that donors don't donate as much in large dollar amounts. And national party support is not as financially strong, and less is spent by outside groups in support of these candidates, especially at the beginning in the primaries. And so if you don't get this pivotal early financial support in primary campaigns, it just builds on itself to support and make stronger these systematic barriers that gatekeep who is able to run at the beginning and who voters are able to get to know.
July, that just sort of brings us back to the question whether these smaller donations now are going to change some of the dynamics in the equation and some of the logic that's going to go behind the electability question, maybe in the cycles ahead.
Definitely. And another point on that, too, is that even when in campaigns we see that the amount of money candidates are able to raise and spend is even, studies have shown that it takes even more money for women, especially women of color, to win elections and to have the same success rates. So a dollar donated to a woman's campaign doesn't take you as far as a dollar donated to a man's campaign. And it plays into, one, the importance of having money boost your campaign. And then, two, if you view small donor money as an interesting correlation to polling.
Well, let's turn
different demographic groups.
Well, let's turn to a smaller race now. House District 59. It's in Guilford County, north and east of Greensboro. Let's take a look at how national interest groups have spent their money in that North Carolina House race. Jason, this is really a reversal of the trend over the past decade, where we've seen the NRA and the Koch brothers flood legislative races with outside money to win redistricting rights, right? Very successful in 2010, certainly. But now how does Bloomberg spending compare to Charles Koch, for instance, in this cycle?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I actually just did a big deep dive on this that I would encourage everybody to go and read. But historically, you're right. Groups like Every Town for Gun Safety, Moms Demand Action, they've been, you know, politically speaking, on the fringe. They've been smaller, and they've really sort of had to try to punch above their weight. Well, as the news has shown here recently, the NRA is likely weaker than it has ever been. You know, the New York Attorney General moved to dissolve the nonprofit, actually saying that it was fraught with fraud and abuse. You know, it's shedding workers. It's had layoffs. It's even in a legal battle with a former marketing partner that it had. So it's fighting battles on a number of different fronts, as opposed to being able to focus just on the election as it has in you know, for decades now. At the same time, as you mentioned, Bloomberg, who supports Every Town for Gun Safety, they've committed to spending $60 million across the nation to help elect what they call "quote unquote" gun sense candidates, and that includes trying to flip state houses, perhaps in states that have been Republican for some time. That includes North Carolina, but also Arizona and even Texas, which are states that you don't necessarily associate Democrats winning majority rule. And the battles are being won and lost for the entire state house in these suburban districts. So you mentioned Nicole Quick, who's running against John Hardister. That's in a suburban district that's basically just outside of Greensboro, to the east of Greensboro, basically. And there's districts like that around Charlotte and even around Raleigh, though to a lesser degree, where Every Town sees winnable seats where they can flip the General Assembly here. And then, you know, from their perspective, tried to introduce some legislation that would restrict, you know, some tighter gun regulation at the state level. This is a strategy that they're doing all over the place. They're not turning away from national politics, clearly, but they're sort of honing in on these smaller races and spending big. The number I'll just throw out there, it's $1.6 million that Every Town is committing to spend in state house races in North Carolina. So a significant amount of money for these smaller races.
And I highly recommend that deep dive that you did. We'll link to it at our website, stateofthings.org. Lots of great information in there. But one of the more interesting things is that money has made it possible for Democratic candidates to talk out loud about gun safety and talk out loud about abortion rights in ways that they have had to conceal or downplay when they've been up against an NRA-supported candidate. Now that the numbers have flipped, the conversation is becoming more open.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's not the main issue, certainly not this year. I mean, the coronavirus pandemic is obviously number one. Healthcare, education, you know, even in Nicole Quick's district, I mean, those are the big issues. But as you say, they're not, you know, people are now willing, candidates, Democratic candidates are now much more willing to say that they're open to, say, a ban on bump stocks or passing red flag laws or things like this where they would sort of call the gun sense. And that's part of the reason why they're targeting these suburban districts, because these are, you know, places where there are a lot of families, kids in elementary and middle schools, where messages like this perhaps resonate a little bit more. And I'll go even deeper. They're actually even targeting suburban mothers. So women are really being targeted with some of these advertisements to sort of hammer home that, hey, this is about the safety of your children in schools. And I wonder, Grace, if I could even just ask you. So, they're really looking at these suburban women. I know you look more at the sort of donation level, but I'm curious if you've looked at, you know, any marketing towards these kinds of voters as well, and if this block really could make a difference in this election.
Yeah, that is a super interesting question, and it's a little bit harder to track with the insane amount of records being filed through the FCC that is able to give us this understanding of political ads. But we're seeing some of these larger ad organizations that are creating these ads specifically targeting women voters for sure. We're seeing the Lincoln Project, which is a group that organizes Republicans against Trump, essentially, and who are spending so much money on ads in support of Joe Biden. And so many of their ads explicitly target moms and dads, focusing on rhetoric and thinking about how their children and how their daughters especially would feel in this current moment with gender being such a huge way and a huge descriptor in the way that politicians are being described, especially Senator Harris and how she's described in her current political moment. So we're seeing so many ads that are explicitly focusing on women, and also on the other hand, using these really extreme masculine tropes as well to bring a certain vibe to the voters.
We are talking about campaign spending today on The State of Things. Grace Haley is gender and race researcher for the Center for Responsive Politics. Jason DeBruin, WUNC's data reporter. Grace, talk more about, though, the trends. So that's a little bit about the messaging. But let's see about tell us more about the trends we're seeing in women donors.
Yeah, definitely. So to historically contextualize this, 2016 was a turning point in fundraising, especially when we look at it from a gender lens. 2016 broke so many records as one of the most expensive elections in history, and it was the first election where women were giving half of a presidential candidate's itemized contributions, which was Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton had over 50% of her itemized contributions coming from women, compared to Trump, who had only 20-something percent of his itemized contributions coming from women, which is big, because usually in presidential elections, we see about 30 to 40% of total funds coming from women. And so since that election, we've seen huge fundraising from women skyrocket in response to all these political moments in the Trump era, as we've seen small donations skyrocket. And in 2018, especially in this cycle, we have really well-organized donor circles full of women, especially Democratic women, maxing out contributions and mobilizing in presidential, Senate, gubernatorial, and House elections. And we're also seeing a rise in super PACs explicitly focused on identity and demographics, like the Black PAC, the AAPI Victory Fund, Emily's List, who focus on providing the essential resources to women, to Black candidates, Asian and Pacific Islander candidates, Latina women, to get elected and to get their preferred candidates elected and to be viewed as competitive candidates.
Wow. So so both at the small donor level, but also now the PACs are organized around women and women's issues.
Yes, definitely. And it's even broadening the scope of what is I guess, traditionally considered a women's issue, right. where it's taking a much more third wave approach of saying, well, every issue is a women's issue. The economy is a women's issue. The recession is a women's issue. Healthcare, gun safety, education, immigration, that these are all women's issues.
Well, I guess that's what we were saying earlier, too, is that, you can actually reframe the debate if you can, if you have enough money to get your candidate to talk about this thing, to raise it to the level of agenda, right? Then you can talk about it, and now you can reframe and reshape the way we talk about these things. So money's having that influence, and Grace, you're saying maybe even at the small donor level.
Yeah, at every level, for sure.
Grace Haley, gender and race researcher for the Center for Responsive Politics. It runs the website making campaign finance records more easily accessible, opensecrets.org. Grace, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Jason DeBruin, WNC's data reporter and a fellow with Guns and America. Jason, thanks much.
You're welcome.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.